This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Visit FUBARradio.com for more details.
Tom Latcham on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, good morning, FUBAR. It's Tom Latcham here. It is 10:03. This is FUBAR Radio, as I say, the UK's home for uncensored, unregulated and ad-free radio. Now, you know how much we love a bit of schadenfreude here on FUBAR Radio, especially when we're laughing at the government. And today, everybody is laughing at the government after peers dramatically threw out the Chancellor George Osborne's planned tax credit cuts, overturning the views of elected MPs. Now, the House of Lords last night voted 289 to 272 to delay the changes, which are central to the government's plan to eliminate a deficit by 2020 and would save £4.4 billion from the welfare bill. They voted to delay that for 3 years until measures could be introduced to protect poor families. Supporters of the move hailed the House of Lords for acting as a balance on what is, they say, an unpopular policy, which the Conservatives not only, they say, failed to put in their manifesto, but in fact said they wouldn't. However, Downing Street said the UK was in uncharted waters after the vote, which goes against centuries of tradition that the House of Commons decides financial matters. However, supporters of Lords pointed out it wasn't actually a financial matter at all, as it was part of the welfare bill, and George Osborne made a mistake by doing so. But what do you think? Was it an example of the House of Lords doing their job? They're often criticised, but is that why they're there? Or was it a bunch of unelected party political Labour and Lib Dem peers acting unconstitutionally, getting their revenge on the Tories? Give us a shout, tom@foobarradio.com. Tweet us at foobarradio or call us on 0330 223 0200. That number again, 0330 223 0200. We'll be talking about that and much more shortly in the news hour with documentary Chris Atkins. They're going through the papers. It's going to be very amusing. I know already there's a lot of fun to be had there, unless they've used it all up already. But also I'll be joined, I am joined today by my co-presenter, the lovely Victoria Richards, who is a journalist for The Independent and Mum, and also is wearing a T-shirt that says Desperate Journalist yes. on. So desperate, in fact. She's joined me here in the studio for 2 hours. How are you, Vic?
Yes, I'm good, thank you. Can I just point out that my T-shirt is actually the name of a band, but I thought it was quite appropriate.
Very good. It is appropriate. Today. We're all desperate journalists in here today. Anything you want to get in touch with, give us a shout. tom@foobarradio.com. Vic, how are you? How's life?
I'm good. I'm existing in a sort of semi-perpetual state of tiredness, if I'm honest. Living with a 3.5-year-old who recently I went to Barcelona and came back and brought her a little flamenco dress as a present, as you do when you go to Spain.
Yeah.
And she's so excited to wear it that she gets up pretty much every morning at 3 a.m. to
wow.
put it on.
That was a mistake, wasn't it? Yeah. Although, to be fair, it's difficult to know. It would have been difficult to predict that. I mean, because... You must buy your little kid lots of stuff all the time.
Yeah.
And she could take to something.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
So.
But to take to something so vigorously that she has to get out of bed at 3 a.m. takes it to another level. So.
And do you have to be involved in that, or can she just parade around in it for a bit and
Tom,
go back to bed?
I have no control whatsoever. Oh, sartorially. No sartorial control over her.
Well, I'm tired too. I didn't sleep very well. I think it was a hangover, kickover from the weekend. It was my birthday.
Oh,
and
happy
so
birthday.
Thank you very much. So I'm exhausted. I didn't sleep very well last night, even though I went to bed early and I was exhausted. You know when you're so tired you don't sleep.
Yes.
In fact, I'm sure as a
yes,
mother, you know it very well.
And what did you do to celebrate your birthday, Tom?
I had an old school rave. Yeah, everyone.
Wow.
Anyone listening to the show knows I like a bit of old school rave. I bought. It was meant to be fancy dress. I said, "Oh, you know, pull out your machino. We're going to do old school garage." Pull out your fancy dress, and I suddenly realised with 2 days to go, I hadn't bought any fancy dress. Machino shirts are like £150. I'm like, I'm not paying £150 something that is horrible, and I'm never going to wear again. So I went to the TK Maxx, and I bought myself a long sleeve Ralph Lauren polo shirt,
amazing.
Some Reebok classics, and a Nike cap. And then I got home, put it on, and I just realised it was my normal clothes, just with a cap on.
Well, I was going to say, why didn't you just pull out your wardrobe from
yes,
your raving era?
I will. I'll wear it again. It's handy.
Of course
it's,
you will.
Handy fancy dress that you can wear again. frugal, if nothing else. Now, I want to know, I had my birthday this weekend. It was a good birthday until it got to Sunday when Bournemouth, my team, got hammered 5-1 at home by Spurs. Last year on my birthday, we beat Birmingham 8-0. So it's gone from very high to very low in just 1 year. But I want to know, what's your best and worst birthdays? Get in touch, tom@foobarradio.com. Tweet us at foobarradio. Call us 0330 223 0200. Vic, stay there. Coming up, we'll be featuring an interview with top comic and writer Andy Hamilton, who's going on tour. He'll be telling us all about that. We've got a new business segment with leading businessman Matt Haycox, and we catch up with our football club in the Sun with commercial director of CD Torrevieja, Chris Darwin. But we'll be doing, as I say, we'll be doing the news hour right after this next song with Chris Atkins, who's a top documentary maker. He's here poised with the papers, I think it's fair to say, rustling them away. But we'll play a song. Vix, how about Rockaway Beach by the Ramones?
Yes, please.
Yes,
I love it.
Let's go for it. It's 10:08 here on Foobar Radio.
Hey, we're the Ramones. This one's called Rockaway Beach. Bye.
Hello, this is Football Radio. I'm Tom Latcham. I'm joined here by co-presenter Victoria Richards. Hello, Victoria Richards.
Hello. Happy to be here.
Yeah, well, I'm happy you're here too. Otherwise, it's just me talking in a room. And also, as I said, documentary Chris Atkins, and he's been here. He's poised with the papers, ready to tell us what is on the front pages. Hello, Chris. How are you, my friend?
I'm very well. Yes, delighted to be here.
Yeah,
delighted.
You look good, mate. You look well for it. What are you up to?
I'm making a documentary about rave culture in Northern Ireland in the 1990s and how it brought the two sides together.
Well, as you know from our intro, I'm a big rave fan. Rave, yeah, although yeah, I was too young for any of those things. How old are you, Chris?
I'm 39.
You're 39, so you were right in the age.
I was, yeah. I mean, I went to raves in the UK, but all the news you saw about Northern Ireland at the time, I mean, you must remember this, was all bombs and bullets and death and misery and Gerry Adams talking with his lips didn't match his voice to the broadcasting band. So that's all you knew about Northern Ireland. But actually, at the time, there was this incredible, massive rave scene out there. And it brought the two sides together because you had Protestants and Catholics both raving in the same place. Some would say with some artificial simulation, and they realised that they weren't all.
Well,
they didn't hate each other.
There's a sort of parallel there with football violence.
With the football, absolutely.
Because obviously we've done a show before. I did a show with a woman called Chelsea Berlin who has written or put together a book of rave flyers from the UK in the late 80s and early 90s. And we did a rave show and we just played some of her old tunes. It was great. It was really good. But she was talking about how, you know, the football violence. It effectively killed it for many years where people just ended up taking drugs together, being friends, and also, as you know from football violence, and I would imagine it's the same with the IRA and all that, and the loyalist groups, they like making a pound coin, and where there is raves, there's money to be made.
Absolutely.
And so the football gangs were coming together to put on raves, sell, knock out their pills, make lots of money, and there's no point, and then they're not going to fight each other on a Saturday, are they?
So. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a good parallel there because people suddenly realise that there's actually a different path as well, and do I really want to spend the next 5 years of my life beating the hell out of someone or maybe another 5 years in prison where actually there's these other things. It opened people's minds to different eventualities.
I was talking to some friends about raving the other day and and they said that they'd seen some hectic stuff and say Bagleys, and I've seen like fights or whatever in Bagleys, RIP Bagleys, not there anymore. And you just think, who goes to a hardcore rave? And which is like basically hands in the air.
How do you start fighting in a rave?
But it takes some real dedication to violence to be fighting in a
pilled up
hardcore rave.
But then became a thing where people used to mix the booze with the pills, and that does send them a bit too lally. I think you need to keep it pure.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it. When are we due? You're cutting it now?
I'm cutting it right now. There's a huge amount to go through. The problem is with Ireland is that everyone has a story. As soon as you speak to one person, you've got to talk to their cousin, their brother, and their aunt, because you want to talk to this guy, you want to talk to this guy, so you can't. We've got about 50 odd interviews, and I'm still shooting now. So
I am. And where will it be screened in the UK, or will it just be in Ireland?
No, well, actually, it's the Americans who are dead and keen on it.
Really?
Of course, the Americans love their Irish heritage, don't they? And they all claim to be Irish. There's all these Irish, but massive Irish community in America. So it's the Americans who are kind of dead keen on it. So I think a sort of smaller independent documentary like I've done before, maybe released in sort of few cinemas, art house cinemas, and you know, maybe a screening on late night TV at 2 in the morning when no one watches. But you know, that's
next year.
I'm not quick with my documentaries.
I'll watch that definitely.
Good,
it's like London Live, right? For anyone who's not in London won't know what this is, but it's basically, you know, they did those local TV stations, they rolled them out around the country, and London Live sometimes hits so few people on the bar rating system, it's fewer than 50,000 people, and I often watch it just because I think I might be the only person watching this. Do you know what I mean? I feel special. They're broadcasting this just for me.
I mean, I was interviewed by London Live, so I watched it because of that, and that's an interesting way to get viewers.
Just interview everyone,
as many people as possible, and then they'll go, "Well, I'm going to tune in because I'm on this." And then,
or
and
really,
then
what they should
it.
Be doing is interviewing all of the 5,000 people who have barb boxes.
Find out who they are,
and then everyone in the country will be watching. As, according to the stats,
I've wanted
of course.
To stiff the barb figures for quite some
time.
They're
nonsense, aren't
they?
They
are just ridiculous, aren't they?
5,000 people can never be proportional. And I was thinking, why don't they just do skyboxes? Because there's 13 million of those. So even if they're a certain type of people, 13 million is always going to be more
It's a really archaic. I always when I get low viewing figures for my Channel 4 documentaries, I always
archaic. And then when you get good ones, you're like, oh, I love that system.
Bang on,
I love that system.
I meant to say as well that actually recently I went to a toddler rave.
Oh, where was
these things exist.
I've seen those. I wanted to do a feature
on
those.
South Bank.
It wasn't. It was
in Ballam.
It was called the Wanstead Tap.
Some sweaty rave
in East London.
No, there was one in Ballam. They won one in Ballam.
Well, they
not that I'm hanging around kid raves or anything, Vic.
Back to your raves.
Bag of sweets.
They were like smoking.
Standing around girls. That's not what I'm doing.
Got smoke machines, happy hardcore stickers, lollipops. It was amazing.
But it's for the parents, right? It's for the parents, isn't it? You know, it's like having a 1-year-old's party.
It is.
It isn't for the 1-year-old, is it?
But all toddlers are like basically tiny drunk humans anyway. That's how they behave. So it worked quite well.
Oh, that sounds fun. Right, more serious matters at hand. What are the papers saying on the front pages today?
Well, the Sun predictably has gone for the sausage story.
What's the sausage story, Chris?
Well, the sausage story is that there's, according to Sun, there's a killer in the kitchen. Basically, people are saying that sausages, processed meat, is suddenly bad for you. This came out a couple of days ago, but it's clearly a story that's going to run and run. If you attack the Great British Breakfast, you will incur the wrath of the Sun newspaper.
Bang it out of order, is their headline.
Bang it out of order. So this was clearly going to be a big story for them. And, you know, I eat a huge amount of processed meat, so I'm terrified.
What sort of meats are you eating, Chris?
Well, I had some processed ham on the way over here to really? Football Radio today,
wow.
Which I'm now regretting. But look at this rasher decision.
Wait, the subhead is bacon as risky as plutonium.
Bacon as risky as plutonium. Yeah.
So what do we think, Vic? Is it?
This is pretty risky, isn't it?
Can't we save that $100 billion on Trident and just send bacon over and a Exocet missile? And it's a lot cheaper. But it gets worse because Vic's found this thing about human DNA.
Oh, yes.
I don't want to scare your listeners.
So I think it's in the Mirror today, isn't it? About...
Basically, they found that, like, about 10%.
Yeah, here we go. So, a shocking one in every 50 hot dogs contains human DNA.
Ooh, delicious.
To latest research. So, they found... what did they find? That 14.4% of Frankfurters contain what they call problematic ingredients.
What's a problematic... What do we think is a problematic human DNA
Well, we could all guess at that.
The Mirror doesn't divulge, but...
No, it does say saliva or other bodily fluids... found or contaminated.
I want to know which type of bodily fluids, because
is
it before
I decide whether it's problematic or not.
That's true.
I want to know what the bodily fluid
is. Objective, whether it's problematic.
Exactly.
That apparently got contaminated during the mashing and processing production line.
14.4% of Frankfurters.
Yes.
And we all know that having a kebab or something, you know, on the way back from the pub is probably a bit of a bad idea, but it's they're saying it's cannibalism.
Yeah.
I mean, let's just say that word. They're saying we're eating other people.
It's very legal, gentlemen, isn't it? But also, traces were also found in 2/3 of vegetarian hot dogs.
Well, that goes to show it's pointless being vegetarian then.
It's clearly from the production line, isn't it? It's not.
So we think this is bored people in a meatpacking factory just.
What, chopping bits of themselves?
That's a lot of bored people. Or
are they sneezing?
Or bashing one out?
Bashing one out. Let's just go there.
And then,
I mean, they're on minimum wage, you know.
There's ways to entertain them.
Absolutely.
The mind boggles, doesn't it?
By the way, with this cancer thing, right, my mate texted me yesterday and went, he said, he's vegetarian. He went, ha, I told you, I've been saying for ages, red meat gives you cancer. Now I'm right. No one listened to me, but now I'm right. And actually, you read the story, and it kind of doesn't. Because, they're putting it in the same category as... cigarettes, asbestos, sunbeds, and that as causes of cancer. But the reality, when you read it, in the UK, 6 in every 100 people get bowel cancer, which isn't that many, right? 6% of people get bowel cancer. Mm. And 21% of those bowel cancers are caused by processed or red meat.
Right.
So that means only 1% of people, if it's 25% of those 6, it's around 1 or 2% of people get cancer from red meat. Mm. I fancy those chances, man. I like pepperoni.
The booze and the fangs and lack of exercise is going to get you first, frankly.
And that's what The Guardian says. It's like, you know, to compare this to cigarettes is completely nonsensical.
But comparing it to plutonium is perfectly valid, yeah.
Well, I mean, but no one's smoking plutonium. But I mean...
Gets a great buzz.
But it's actually disingenuous. Mm. It's dangerous message, because you're saying eating red meat is the same as smoking fags. We already have a problem with people smoking fags, right? Mm. You need to be telling people that it's not. I mean, it is more dangerous. It's literally more dangerous than
But also, there is a positive to eating food, that it keeps you alive and stops you dying of starvation. Where there isn't a positive to smoking, you can quit smoking.
It does make you look cool.
What, eating burgers? No, but that bacon sandwich didn't do very well for the coolest geezer
in the world. I mean, burgers all the time.
How's this for a counter anecdote, though? The world's oldest person, 116-year-old Susanna Mushat Jones, has been asked the secret of how she lives so long, and that's eating bacon every day. So, really?
She doesn't look too good.
She's 116.
Maybe she had more falafel. She'd be 117.
A daily breakfast of bacon, eggs and grits with lots of sleep, she says.
I think it's the sleep that's more likely to be keeping her alive, I would have thought, than the bacon. But, you know.
Born in July 1899. Don't knock it. Imagine that.
I don't think I'd like that. I think I'd like someone to
get a lot of raving done, though, wouldn't you?
But to be honest, I don't think I'd like to. I mean, she's probably all right, you know. She's probably quite healthy. She doesn't need help. But, like, once you need that help, I just want to be out of here. And I think that, fortunately, by the time we're older, assisted suicide will be legal.
Oh, you think so?
Definitely. I mean, it's moving there. Within the next 10, 20 years, it'll be legal.
That's interesting, though, because every time it comes before the Commons and the Lords, it gets overwhelmingly voted down, not just by a little bit. And it's because of the religious lobby hit up all the MPs and the Lords and say, oh, no, because we'll start killing our grannies to get their inheritance. And they vote overwhelmingly against it. So I agree with you. I'm totally with you on that. But our legislators just always go against it.
Now, we should probably, the other major story of the day, and it's a story that's on the front of the Mail, the Mirror, not the Mail, the Mirror and the Guardian, is this whole voting down of the government tax credit plans. I mean, I've talked a little bit about the detail in the opening, but how are the papers? I mean, what I'm interested in is how the papers are dealing with it. And actually, even the Sun, which is the mouthpiece of the government historically, certainly recently, is going for the government over this, and not only on this, but also on their their perceived failure of their EU negotiations. It's interesting, isn't it, that is this where the tide turns? I mean, you know, where obviously Thatcher had the poll tax that really hit them and sent them into chaos. Is this the current Conservative Party's poll tax?
Well, I mean, the Sun knows its readers, and I think a lot of Sun readers are in that key demographic that are going to be losing out on this. And I think the Sun is more than aware of that, which is why it's campaigning.
But I always found that weirdly about the Sun's coverage of the Conservatives. The Conservatives are so not the Sun's, the sort of person that, you know, they're not, the Sun is not their target market. And so for them to so blindly support them the whole way through the election, I found very strange.
What, are you suggesting some kind of backdoor deal with a certain media empire who happens to own the Sun?
Yes! I mean, I'm not suggesting it, I'm saying it. Yeah. I mean, of course, Rupert Murdoch, his views come through his papers, and actually he wants the Tories in, right?
But he wants money, and if he turns on his readers, you know, they know that the working poor, if you want to call them that, buy the Sun. And it's the working poor who are going to be. I saw this graphic the other day in the Sun where it was like, it said, you know, courier driver, taxi driver, chipman, whatever, all these different jobs, and how much exactly they're all going to lose. And they're Sun readers. And the Sun knows if it doesn't represent them and support them, they won't buy the paper, and Rupert Murdoch will lose money. So I think fundamentally they're going to go with their readers.
I'd be interested. Obviously, I've only ever worked at sort of you know, TV editor level. It's not an executive position at the News of the World. I'd be really intrigued to know. So, the editor speaks to Rupert Murdoch. At what point does he feed something back up the line to say, "Look, we've got this piece in that says your van drivers are going to be this much worse off. Your painters are going to be worth much worse off. We shouldn't be supporting this." And Murdoch goes, "You're right. We can't support on this topic."
Yeah.
I'm intrigued at how much daily interaction goes. I mean, I'm sure he's on the phone to Tony Gallagher, the editor, all the time. But
I think certainly with the Sun, if you look historically and you look at what people like Kelvin McKenzie and David Yellen said, obviously after they left the job, you know, it's that with the Sun in particular, they were on the phone to Murdoch the entire time. And I think some of his other papers, the Times, Sunday Times, were slightly more autonomous, but the Sun was always what Rupert thinks. So I think certainly the fact that they turned on the government over tax credits would definitely have been cleared with Murdoch. But I think it's a commercial decision because that's it's their readers that are being affected.
What the Mail does particularly well, and I don't know if Tony Gallagher's perhaps bringing this sort of influence in, because he was, of course, number two at the Daily Mail until he was given the editor's job at The Sun. The Mail is a Tory paper, but it doesn't really like the current Tories. So true. You know, and it hates Cameron and it hates Osborne, and it does, and it reflects that. It says, yes, you know, we want a Tory government, but not this one. And so actually I wonder if Tony Gallagher's influence there from the Mail, you know, we can stick it to the government. Because it was embarrassing, actually, I've got to say, how pro-government The Sun has been over the last few years, and this has changed. Maybe it's the issue.
Well,
maybe
the refugee crisis was another one as well, where they put the drowned boy on the front page and said, "Come on, Cameron, do something." You could almost see Cameron just sitting there going, "But we're bashing immigrants because it's what The Sun wants, and now you don't want us to bash immigrants, or we're confused. Tell us what to do, please."
Well, to be honest, The Sun was confused because one day they said something horrible about them, and the next day they were going, "Oh, let's sort this out."
So it's gone back again now, too, hasn't it?
It's gone back again.
Yeah, it's gone.
Anyway, enough of that seriousness. Let's play a song, and then we'll come back with some of the lighter stories in the paper. How does that sound?
Lovely.
Chris, what song would you like?
There's a Bond theme. We were talking about great old Bond tracks, and we said Live and Let Die, but then we thought actually the Guns N' Roses version is a bit better than the Paul McCartney version.
Well, of course, last night was the premiere of Spectre, so that seems like an apt song to play. Let's play it. Excellent. It's Football Radio, 10:26.
You were young and your heart was an open book. This ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give in and cry. Say, live and let die.
This is FUBAR Radio. I'm Tom Latcham. It's 10:29. I'm still joined in the studio by Chris Atkins, who's a renowned documentary maker, but a documentary maker who does seem to get himself into quite a lot of trouble. And and also Victoria Richards, who is a desperate journalist for The Independent. She's my co-presenter for the day, I'm pleased to say. We've been going through the papers. We've done the heavy stuff, but there's some fun light stuff as well today. Which one should we start with, Chris Atkins?
I can't stop reading this article in the Daily Mail about the touchability index.
Right. What is a touchability index?
Well, thankfully, we have Oxford University on hand. Oxford University scientists have created this map of the human body and where it's appropriate to touch a stranger and where it's inappropriate to touch a stranger. Some would say this is a statement of the bleeding obvious, but it goes on for about 20 paragraphs. But what it says is that men, it seems, have no areas which will be completely off limits to a touch from a total stranger. As long as the stranger is a woman. but women, on the other hand, this is quite amazing. A woman is happy to be stroked on her back by her uncle, but not her front.
It's very strange.
And also, men here, this is one that jumped out at me. Men are happy to be stroked all mostly down their front by their aunts, but the crotch is out of bounds. I'm pleased to say
for the aunt.
But for other people, women don't like being touched anywhere by a stranger, do they? Effectively, that's so. What happens on a date? A first date, you know, because you know sometimes you get lucky, don't you, on a first date?
Not if she's a lady.
Yeah,
no, not, you know,
frigid. They're frigid. That's what they're saying. Frigid.
Oh, Tom, don't stop.
What do you think?
Well, I mean,
as a woman,
I quite like the colour coding of the graphic that's in the mail. So we've got like a stick figure of a woman, a stick figure of a man, and the black areas that are shaded in are taboo. And basically, on the woman, it's her entire body
all
is black.
Of it. No, her wrists are all right.
Her ankles are okay, and our faces are okay, and sort of the top of our.
You're welcome to wrists.
Yes, and wrists are absolutely fine.
Plain sailing.
But on men, I mean, everywhere is pretty much okay on the male graphic, isn't it?
Yes, so, but it's the way that they then code them by aunt, uncle, female acquaintance.
Yes, it's very interesting. I mean, I suppose women in society are sort of much more sensitive to being touched by strangers. It happens to us a lot on the tube, it happens to us a lot in the street,
but
even.
In radio stations.
It's
been happening already this morning.
But
we're not strangers here at FUBAR Radio. We're all
big happy family.
Acquaintances.
You're like my uncle, and as such, you can touch me except in my ovaries.
I just think women are more sensitive and more. Come on, guys, take this.
But I says we're a
women don't like being goosed. I think that's what. But well, it's about the Oxford University has to come out and tell us.
A female stranger can touch a man. And it says,
if only it's
least uncomfortable across the body, including the crotch. If a female stranger touched my penis, I've got to say, that is taboo,
well,
isn't it?
Unless money had changed hands.
Why isn't it taboo? Why isn't that taboo on this map? Why are some blokes going, I tell you what, I don't care who it is, I'll take it.
Yeah, I think this is the problem with reporting, though, isn't it? I think it's that sense of bravado and saying, like, oh no, I wouldn't mind if a woman touched
true,
my crotch.
Isn't it? Yeah.
So I think it's one of these things where if you looked at the actual results of the study, like, people would say a different thing to what they really think. That's what I think was going on here. Really.
That's very true. Yeah, that is true.
I just think, isn't there something better that Oxford University scientists could or should be doing than creating a touchability index? I mean, has cancer been cured?
No, because too much bacon.
They should sort out the bacon cancer problem.
Yeah, they should be creating non-cancerous bacon and sausages.
Yeah. Not giving me a map that tells me that if I grope a woman, it makes her feel uncomfortable, because I know that from bitter experience.
It's an international map, though. It's quite interesting, isn't it? Didn't they survey...
Well, they surveyed lots of countries, including Russia, which could be the problem, because Russia does have boundary issues, as we know from its recent excursions.
Very clever, very good.
Into Ukraine and other territories. Chris, they have boundary problems.
Yeah. That's the kind of...
I have no concept of
political reporting that you get from a Channel 4 filmmaker.
Yeah. Cross-referencing on FUBAR Radio. Well done, Chris. I think that probably they could be coming up with something better. But what does it say as well about Oxford Uni? That they think that they just touch whoever they want.
Yeah, maybe. Exactly. Well, it's all that Piers Galveston stuff. I mean, pigs.
Exactly.
It comes back to everything. Goes back to bacon.
You know that Piers Galveston story.
I went to a Piers Galveston party. It was rubbish.
Did you?
Yeah, it was absolutely terrible.
Was Ian Hislop there? Because I was stunned to learn that Ian Hislop has apparently was in Piers Galveston.
He admitted that, didn't he?
But anyone could be in Piers Galveston as long as you gave £50. I mean, that was the thing. It was a total rip off. It was
like a social club.
It was a terrible
man's club
rave.
But wasn't this one where you burn a £50 note in front of a homeless person to be eligible for entry?
I don't remember doing that, but I don't remember a lot of my time at Oxford. So
and then
the recent one where a man was stood on a table welcoming people in a toga, and as he was welcoming people in, a couple of blokes lifted up the toga and started noshing him off. I was like, I think I want to stay in Italy, honestly. I think this is a bit weird.
Can we get back on the bus?
What other stories? You liked a story about a marathon runner.
There's something about the sheer bravado and chutzpah of this guy I absolutely love. So this is the Nairobi Marathon, which I follow diligently every year. And this year, it's paid off because this one guy has been banged up, essentially, for cheating because he started the marathon. He then hid in the crowd for 25 of the mile. Well, everyone else was running around giving themselves a heart attack. And then nipped out at the end and joined in and came in second. And he clearly could have come first, but he thought, I don't want to draw too much attention to my con here. So just ambled into second place.
But apparently officials said they only became suspicious because he showed no signs of fatigue and wasn't sweating. Yeah. But then it can't be very highly watched, otherwise you would see a man
come out of the crowd,
coming into the crowd and joining in.
Yeah. But should he send the hot dog stand or someone? Didn't someone say, hang on, you've still got that number on, weren't you? But I remember doing this at school on the cross country runs.
Exactly.
You'd nip in the bush, you'd go to the pub, you'd nip in the bushes, have a fag, and then come out at the end. But I would always make myself look awful and well, go, and like overdo it. And this guy hasn't learnt from that. He obviously just came out in a suit or something with a cigar holder or something. And hello dear boy, you look all out of breath. You know, you've got to act the part if you're going to cheat.
I love that you'd only run like barely 1 kilometre.
Exactly.
It's amazing.
But I think you should get a medal for bravado. Yes. He shouldn't be banged up.
I agree.
There's a dog in the news, is there?
Oh, there's always a dog in the news.
But there's a dog in the news today.
This is the British Press. Is that in the Sun? Yeah. This is a story that I absolutely love because I think it sums up the sort of British work ethic. Is this dog that won't get out of bed? You seem down, boy. Meet Jasper the Springer Spaniel. God, I love the sum of these stories. He's so depressed in kennels, he cannot get out of bed. But this is the problem with the British workforce. We're too lazy, and Jeremy Hunt was banging on about this, and the Chinese dogs, they're up at the crack of dawn, and they put in a full day's work, while Jasper's just ambling around in the sack.
Oh, he's depressed.
Is he ambling around in the sack?
He is. He's from Chard, Somerset, and all he needs is a bit of love.
Oh.
Just pull yourself together, you know. Just get up, go and catch a ball.
A dog's life is easy, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, what do you have to do? Why? But it is. But animals do get depressed, don't they?
And also, this is a big come and burgle me. Basically, we've practically got their address here. You know that this is the world's worst dog. So burglars, if you're listening, Chard, Somerset, because the dogs there are all knackered and work shy. Basically,
I wonder what's wrong with Chard. I mean, because there's a dog in charge that's thinking, nah, I ain't going out. I'm not going
maybe
out.
He's
it's too bleak.
They've shut the only nightclub. You know, it's a one dog town, and the dog can't. Jasper, just pull yourself together, Jasper.
And I mean, if dogs in Wolverhampton can go out, then a dog in charge can go out. Why is this? Why am I saying this?
Well, because Wolverhampton is the misery capital of the UK. Again, do we need the Mail to tell us this? You ever been to Wolverhampton? This is a statement of the obvious.
You both have personal connections to Wolverhampton.
We do. My mother and all of my aunts and uncles on that side are from Wolverhampton, and I can...
Would you concur?
Are these the aunts that would or wouldn't touch your front?
Pardon?
The aunts who would or wouldn't touch your front, would touch your
all
back.
All over. But at my insistence.
Right.
But the headline on the Sun is Wolverhampton.
Oh. Wolverhampton.
Wolverhampton. City is revealed to be the unhappiest in Britain. And Wolverhampton is as glum as its most famous son, a report says today. I love this. The Sun can't just say that the town's miserable. They have to
work itself
more bad
into
news
the story.
For One Direction's Liam, who is from Wolverhampton. One Direction's Liam Payne's home city has been rated Britain's most miserable place. It may add to the woes of the 22-year-old who split from his girlfriend Sophia Smith, 21, and suffered a backstage meltdown.
Do you think he's reading this? There go, if my day couldn't get any worse.
Yes.
They voted my hometown the most. How often do you think he actually goes back to Wolverhampton?
Not
think
that
he flies
often.
Over its airspace on the
not
way to
often.
Los Angeles.
I wonder if this could end One Direction. I mean, finally.
The final nail in the coffin.
The nail in the coffin, One Direction. It was the Sun what done it.
So while Blackpool, Liverpool...
Have you been to Blackpool, by the way? I mean, look, I've been to Blackpool quite a lot.
I've filmed in Blackpool. It's absolutely horrendous place.
I go there every year to do the Strictly Come Dancing Blackpool special.
Mm. Really?
It's very bleak. I mean, even the best hotel in town is like... complete dive.
Friendly bomb. Friendly bomb
is
what you
kind
mean.
Of affectionate British.
No. It's stag and hens. city when I was there.
And heroin addicts and underage child prostitutes, unfortunately. Right. Because basically, like Margate...
But there are bad signs as well.
Like Margate, you know, if you... it's basically everyone in Lancashire sends... They've got so many B&Bs that aren't being used there. Everyone in Lancashire, all the social services in Lancashire, basically send their vulnerable people down to Blackpool as if their lives weren't bad enough.
Is that you as well? Is that why you're there?
I'm there. Yeah. Yeah. But it has. It's very bad. It's very bad. And so I think it's worse than Wolverhampton. Mm. Frankly, I'm going to go out on a limb there and say that
we
fan Blackpool.
We should do a tour.
Yeah.
We should
and go and sample it. Like, Liverpool's fine. Like, Liverpool is fine.
They celebrate their misery. I mean, I don't come over all Boris Johnson on this, but that's part of the sort of dour scouse thing. It's part of the kind of local character to be
most prosperous. Hammersmith and Fulham and Kensington and Chelsea, Westminster, Wandsworth, Camden and the City of London, and the Outer Hebrides.
Hang on, most prosperous or happiest?
But it, I mean, it does say a report came today. Which report? I mean, is this from the university have just made it up? Mm. I mean, you know, I mean, sometimes with these reports, it just
the Geography of Prosperity Index.
Yeah. I know, it's just another. Oh, okay.
From the Legutum Institute.
That just sounds like a bit.
It's a think tank.
A bit postboxy, doesn't it?
It's a think tank.
Do they even have an office?
All the important issues in town.
Yeah.
Chris, do you want to stick around?
I could. I've got nothing else to do.
Do you fancy sticking around?
Give me 5 more minutes. Yeah, that's fine.
Stick around. We'll talk some more light stuff after this. Coming up, we've got an interview with Andy Hamilton, who's a stand-up comedian. He's going on tour, and we'll be playing that out. But first, we'll play your second song, Chris.
This is probably going to depress people even more than Wolverhampton, this song. But it's John Grant, who I've only just suddenly got into, and he's a fine artist. So it's called GMF by John Grant.
Probably say I'm difficult. I probably talk too much. I overanalyze and overthink things. Yes, it's a nasty crush.
More of the time, I should have practiced my escapes. I should not be attracted to males, but you said that I should learn to love myself. Make up your mind, Dr.
It's 10:46 here. It's Tom Latcham, joined in the studio by my co-presenter for the day. I've been told to say she's freelance journalist, Victoria Richards, so she doesn't get in trouble.
With very reasonable rates,
yes,
as well.
Yeah.
Freelance for hire.
Get in touch here. We all are. And also
doing anything.
The other voice there is Chris Atkins, who's a documentary maker, whose last documentary, by the sounds of it, broke records for Ofcom complaints.
Yes. It got over 6,000 angry letters from UKIP supporters.
Is that a record? That must be a record.
No, it can't be because of... Joey Springer, the opera, got like 70,000. That's the high watermark to
me. And
be.
Also
Big Brother.
Jonathan Ross.
No, we got more than him.
Oh. Did you?
I got more than Saxgate. I got more than the Jade Goody Racism Row. And there was like a moment that week where we kept punching through barriers. And I was thinking, I'm going to start complaining. I was getting my mates to complain. I was like, come on, let's get a record going on here.
You read all through the letters, too.
I had to read quite a lot of them. And these people,
must have been eye-opening.
They don't have a great grasp of the English language, I have to say. Some of these UKIP supporters,
which is ironic, is it really?
but we did defend ourselves under human rights grounds, which I think it irritated them even more, given their loathing of the human rights.
Going over the papers, but now we've decided to move away from the papers and into some of the other things that we've seen in the last week that are amusing. I've asked Victoria to come up with a few, and she's come up with one about Jeremy Corbyn, isn't that right?
Yes, and this is one of my favourite stories of...
It's not a story, is it?
It's not a story.
It's
a favourite poll. I mean,
it's a weird. I don't even know
an
what it
online,
is.
So Tatler basically have done a 10-point list to inform us just how posh Jeremy Corbyn really is. And I'd just like to take us through some of those spurious claims. So, for example, my favourite ones, I'm skipping to number three here, is that he has a son called Ben who looks like Zach Goldstein.
Hang him!
that really amused me.
It's practically Bullying the Club, isn't it?
Exactly. It's practically Piggate all over again. Number six as well, skipping ahead, is the fact that Jeremy Corbyn apparently gets married all the time.
Because every day.
Yeah, because working class people never get married more than once.
But wait, before we talk, we need to skip on to point seven, which... You know, carries on from that point to say to women with names like Jane and Claudia.
to those women. He's only been married three times now, hasn't
he?
To a Spanish woman.
And I don't need to read about Shropshire, but it says he grew up in a 7-bedroom house in Shropshire, which is not like saying 7-bedroom house in Fulham.
It costs like £3.
I know, exactly.
I'm from Shrewsbury. That's cheap.
That's not that posh.
No. I love it. And I love it that point 10 as well, he's from Islington, which is where we are.
from Islington, it says, need we say more?
Need we
well,
say more.
Yes, actually.
But it is the home of screaming lefties, Islington. So
it is. Well, yeah. Are you from Islington?
I'm not. I'm not left enough. I mean, you've got to be proper full-blooded commie.
It reminds me of The Spectator have just joined, have just launched a quarterly... men's mag, lads
really?
Mag. Yeah, because there weren't enough. There wasn't enough representation for posh people in the media.
Oh,
you know,
wow. All men.
All men. And
is this Toby Young?
It's Toby Young. Edits this.
Yes.
And,
oh my goodness!
And the first issue is fantastic. On the cover, it's got Evgeny Legvedev, who is the owner of the
proprietor of a great newspaper,
The Independent, of course. Victoria, who sometimes works there, but she is freelance.
She is freelance.
But also, it said. Inside the most dangerous job in the country, being a right-wing commentator on Newsnight.
Really? Because they hardly ever get them on.
Wow.
I mean, Kelvin McKenzie, I mean, where's he now?
I mean, you can forget about mining.
Yeah.
Or being a lion tamer.
Yeah.
No, being a right-wing contributor to Newsnight is the most dangerous job
amazing.
In the world. The story that I've liked this week is, and it's basically the... it's the story that keeps giving, really. It's Tom Jones's autobiography, and he's given an interview to The Big Issue. We've talked about it on the show before about his some of the things that he said about his wife losing her spark, etc., etc.
Such an old romantic.
He basically does a sort of Q, you know, sort of a. It's not really an interview; it's just a sort of stream of consciousness, basically.
Stream of unconsciousness.
But this bit is the most that I found most enjoyable, and I'll do it in his accent. I was ready for most aspects of the music industry, but when I met the producer Joe Meek, that threw me off a bit because he was a homosexual. I thought, wait a minute, is the London scene, the people who run British showbiz, there are a lot of homosexuals involved here? Because if so, I'm going back to Cardiff. So much so that when I signed with Decca and Peter O'Sullivan became my manager, and he said the same thing Joe Meek said, tell the boys to pack their gear up, I want to talk to you. I became paranoid, you see. I wondered, was that what was required to make a hit record? But then I got into it and I realised, no, it just so happened that the first guy to record me was a homosexual producer. Once I got over the shock of that, I realised it wasn't true. Most people were normal. Well, I shouldn't put it like that. Homosexuals are normal. It's just that they're not normal. It's just that they are what they are.
Oh,
if you find a better paragraph in a celebrity interview this year, I defy you to find it.
That's
there
a
you
stunning
go.
It's almost
back,
like Craig Brown wrote that for Private Eye. He's sending himself up more than any satirist.
I don't know if you try it at home. It is fun to say homosexual.
Homosexual,
in
I love
in
that.
A Cardiff accent.
I'm going to be saying that on the bus today, and I'm probably get arrested. But
really
it's accompanied by a photograph of Tom. He's not looking at his best.
No.
There, and he's ranting
his wife
about
thinks he's lost his spark.
Oh.
He's lost more than his spark. Jesus.
Wow.
So yes, there you go. Tom Jones. I mean, by the way, I did flag up an interview that he did recently to the Sun, where he said that Jimmy Savile was a good man on Radio 5. Time to shut up now, Tom. Shut up now. I think your legendary showbiz status slipping away. Be quiet now. What else have we noticed?
That could segue into the Gary story, couldn't it?
Yes. Well, do it.
Yes.
In fact, it's perfect. Yes, perfect.
I'm all up for paedophilic segues. that just sounds so wrong. So, Gary is on the way out.
Then I think I've just accidentally pressed the button. Hold
Gary
on.
Is no more.
Let's stop that. Let's take that off. There we go.
Right. Sorry.
I pressed it with my stories. I got excited about Gary Glitter.
Yeah.
There you go. So Gary is on the way out.
The name Gary.
No more. It's
specify.
Dying out as a word, as a name for each other because... Well, why is Gary on the way out?
Well, exactly. I mean, 28 of 700,000 babies born in 2013.
Well, it's dying out because there's no famous Garys anymore. You know, people are basically moronic, and they will call their children after someone who happens to be vaguely in.
The public eye. Gary
Lineker obviously was the last time. So no one under 30, basically. There's no Garys under 30.
Yeah, Gary
because
Neville,
Gary Lineker.
Gary
Lineker, you're not going to name
it.
Your kid after Gary Neville, are you? I mean, as good a right back as he was. You know,
Gary Barlow, still the housewife's favourite. But do you think mums are now? Because I mean, were you a Take That fan, Vix?
I wasn't actually.
Weren't
no,
you?
I wasn't.
But
no.
Your
her
generation
name
was.
But it was my generation.
Her kid's name's Howard,
really. And the girl called Howard. But I thought Gary Barlow would still be pulling in some traction there.
I think the
elephant in the room is, of course, Gary's taken a bit of a knock because of Gary Glitter, and I think that's sort of solid the Gary. Image now that parents are going, do I really want to name my son after
the big names
fault?
Now
There were things from Game of Thrones.
One of them was Dexter, which was like, right. I imagine, after the serial killer.
Yeah.
But he was a cool serial killer, though. That's the thing.
I think we're allowed to do that.
Gary Glitter, who was now a deeply
uncool paedophile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, it's mostly named after Game of Thrones and stuff like that.
Maybe it needs one of the Kardashians to name their kids Gary.
Yes. Yes.
Maybe we need to start a campaign to bring back Gary.
That's what
Gary
we like. North
Gary Kardashian.
Northwest Gary.
I mean, or the Beckhams, they've got enough kids to go around.
Yes.
They're going to eventually call them Gary. They'll just run out of other names.
And there's a story in the Mail today, which I liked, about a young girl. She sounds like an idiot. But she's 15, and she found... Oh, no, she's younger than that. Sorry. She found 15 glaring examples of apostrophes in the wrong place during a 15-minute walk around a local market, flagged it up to the teacher, who then told the newspapers. She sounds...
That she's unbearable.
Really annoying.
But it is one
of those things that does my nut in. I had an ex-girlfriend who would write in text messages, I'm... And I'm like, that's what the apostrophe's
is
for.
Is that why you split up with her?
That's what the apostrophe's for. Like, there's no A. Like, it doesn't even make sense. It's harder.
Women love it when you undermine their grammar and point out their educational failings.
I tried not to for quite a while.
But it did build up.
And then I just couldn't take it any longer. And I just had to tell her. She also referred to Vietnamese as Viet Munies. And she would also call the famous brand that Margaret Thatcher used to wear, Aquascutum. Aquascrutum.
It was never going to work. I found journalists, particularly tabloid journalists, are really hardcore on their apostrophes and punctuation in general.
Do you know what I find with my daughter? So the other day she said, "Oh, mummy, the cat bited me." But before I went over to help her, I said automatically, "The cat bit you."
Do it again. Bite her again.
Corrected her
until
grammar.
She gets it right. Corrected bite it. Her again.
Keep
and
getting
then
mauled.
Went with plasters, basically.
Yes, yeah. Plasters, what? To sort of plaster over the grammar mistake. Yeah,
exactly.
Wow. And what else? We've got a couple of minutes left before we bid goodbye to Mr. Atkins. What else have we
got? I found something. I'm going to present this straight without comment. Okay, right. You can help me here, guys. So, okay. In the
Probably
tab
not.
This week, the tab, the assistant editor, Will Lloyd, has written something about how he will not perform oral sex on a lady.
Right.
He says he was...
Is there a reason for this?
Well, you sort
the
of
The tab
through...
is... this is Oxbridge magazine.
It was started by a Cambridge... Yeah,
let's give it some context.
Yes,
he goes online. To... Is it Oxford or Cambridge?
Yeah.
One of them,
I mean,
right.
He's never going to fit into Piers Gamble, is he?
Never going to fit it in.
This is someone who's never going to get laid ever again, isn't it? Basically.
Do you think?
Basically...
Is he off your list now?
He's talked about how much he doesn't like it. You get to the bottom and I think apparently he, so to speak, and he says that he had a sort of a traumatic experience the first time.
Wow, what
happened? Cunnilingus on her.
What
on
happened?
How traumatic can it be?
So
I can see a photo of him.
So this is why he doesn't do it. But I mean, what I found interesting about this is the sort of stuff that you're willing to say forever, put your name to on the internet. Mm. I mean, think about this.
I love my Facebook feed because I've got some lunatics on there. One person was like an 18-year-old kid. He's had a bad life, to be fair. And he was like, 9 days without a sniff. Boom! And you're like, don't put that on Facebook, mate. I mean, like, that's not a good thing. Another one, just found out that my husband's been cheating on me for 6 years.
Maybe the new dislike button. But every time Will goes to the pub, people are going to say, "Oh, you're the guy that doesn't like going down on women." I'm so pleased to meet you.
Well, he could at least claim honesty here. He could say that he's... informing the debate, he's
great with his fingers. I think a lot of people don't, Vic. I've got to say, I think it's a wider phenomenon. Having done a straw poll of my girlfriend,
with a terrible apostrophe,
I think I think that actually it's more common than they think.
Well, it's interesting this piece, actually.
But he looks loaded,
yeah,
so he'll probably get a few girls.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that's all women want, but he looks like. He's got a few quid in the bank.
I mean, he did say that when he talks about this, his stance with other men, when women are present, the other men will say, "Oh, God, you're such an idiot. You know, what's wrong with you?" But when it's just men alone, they'll all agree. Interesting.
There we go.
He's just digging his own hole.
Mm. There we go. We've come to the end of the section. Chris Atkins, thank you for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
Please come back again because it's been fun.
I'd love to.
Where can people find you on Twitter?
Scat Atkins.
Why are you called Scat?
Yeah.
Atkins.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it was a drunken joke that didn't really land 4 years ago. But I thought, why not?
No, it's too late.
I complain about television and quote Lord of the Rings. That's what I do on Twitter. So.
Fine, okay. We'll follow if you want that.
I wouldn't allow you.
We're going to play out. Chris is going to go now, but thanks for coming and do come again.
Delighted to be here.
We're going to play out an interview with Andy Hamilton now, who's the writer and comedian you've seen on loads of programmes, including Carmarthen News for You, and he wrote Outnumbered, etc., etc. And then we're going to be coming up with a new business feature. Vic's going to be staying with us, a new business feature with Matt Haycock's businessman. Mm-hmm. But we shall, we'll play. I think there's a song with Randy Hamilton. There's no song with Randy Hamilton, but it doesn't. We'll play a song first.
Okay.
One of yours.
Great.
Vic's. What about the Shangri-Las?
Yes.
Yeah. All right.
Yes.
The Shangri-Las.
Bit of soul for
Remember
Tuesday.
Walking on the Sand. A bit lovely song.
Yes. There we go.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
This is Tom Latcham. Joining me now is award-winning comedian and comedy writer Andy Hamilton. Andy's going back on the road this autumn with a brand new solo show called Change Management, which, says the PR bump, contains mild peril. So, Andy, why peril and why only mild?
That's just a disclaimer. That's just we're just covering our backsides legally.
Because you're like absolutely fuming.
Because you never know, you know, you might upset someone or you might damage them emotionally in some way, and it's a compensation culture now. So you know, we just fling that in.
And so, what peril might there be? What could there be?
The peril, the peril of laughing too much.
Good.
Of bursting some internal organ from laughter. That's the biggest peril.
So your shows are always very messy afterwards. The audience
can
just,
be.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. So what's this show about? It's called Change Management. What is it about?
It's about change.
Oh, right, okay.
I've reached
a
stage of my life where I thought I could maybe risk looking back and seeing how things change. It's been quite interesting, actually, because it's made me think about change and what's happened. And what's been really interesting is at first I thought, things have changed so much, everything changes so fast. But actually, very few things are changes of substance. You know, most of them are changes of degree. Mm. Things get faster or bigger, you know. But but there's very few that are changes of substance or that haven't happened before, you know. So it's about sort of changing people, how we attitudes, You know, I'll be sticking up for the 70s a bit, because the 70s have been taking a lot of stick.
Have they?
Recently. Yeah, you know.
For they want to get a better PR.
Being in a, yes, they do.
Could you remember when the 80s were shit?
Yeah, and but now they're good. I don't know why it is that
they got a PR.
Yeah.
The 80s got a PR. I think the 70s rested on their laurels.
I think the 70s fell out with someone, and then that was it, yeah.
So, I mean, what sort of other changes, what changes specifically do you examine? Is it sort of changes in your own life or in society?
Yeah, I've taken a few incidents from my childhood and tried to imagine...
White dog shit.
Right, that's not on the list, funnily enough.
But then you don't get white dog shit anymore.
Well, that's probably a marketing thing. But so I look at social changes and how we've changed. You know, I mean, we're a generation that's, you know, grown up in a very peaceful, sort of affluent time. You know, so we are different from our parents and our grandparents. You know.
Do you see that changing? Excuse the pun, it's not really a pun, just using the word that you're using. Do you see that changing into the next generations? The reason I ask this is that we've got Jeremy Corbyn has come into power at the Labour Party. There are protests and riots about austerity and against gentrification and all that sort of thing. Do you think that we're moving into a more unstable period? Do you see that?
I don't know. I mean, it's possible we are. We've been through quite a protracted period where the poor and the rich have drifted further and further apart. It's hard to imagine that won't have any consequences. I mean, I think there must be. I think there might be a little bit of a wobble.
Because, of course, we had, once upon a time, there were, Victorian ages, whatever, there were huge gaps between the rich and the poor, but they were narrowed, weren't they? Sort of post-war, probably with the welfare state.
In fact, in the 70s, that's when that gap got to its narrowest.
Really?
Yeah, and then after that, I don't know. I mean, I remember presuming that process would continue. You know, I remember thinking, you know, when I was growing up, I was thinking, well, there'll always be free education and there'll always be free healthcare. You know, and if you'd stopped the clock and said, well, do you know, we'll be governed by a cabinet of old Etonians, I would have thought, no, that's a risible idea. But also, if you'd said, but the Berlin Wall will be down and Nelson Mandela would be president of South Africa, I would have also thought, well, that's...
It's funny that... You would have thought that people would long for days like the 70s where inequality was at its lowest point.
Yeah.
Rather than the country and certainly the media, the right-wing media, but that's pretty much the whole media, sort of celebrated Thatcherism, which then accelerated it the other way.
Yeah. No, well, I thought that the tributes to Mrs. Thatcher were... Yeah, I thought they left quite a lot out. You know, I thought that there were several of her attributes that didn't get a mention. And, you know, I can remember doing a show at the Latchmere. And then I did a show a few years later after the boom of sort of yuppies had moved into... And the atmosphere was completely different. Suddenly the audience was full of
twats,
who were quite happy to boast about how much money they were earning.
Really?
And I remember thinking, this is a change, you know.
What makes, do you think, if you do think this indeed, that the UK is such a good place for stand up? And I suppose, in a way, you know, you've just said a bit of the change into the Thatcher era. How has stand up comedy in the audiences changed more recently? I mean, because you see, of course, Michael McIntyre doing the big arenas. I've been to a couple of those arena tours. And I mean, I don't like Michael McIntyre anyway. I don't think his comedy is particularly... I think he's an incredible comedian. I just think his material's shit. But I've been to these things, and even actually Greenwich, I went the other day to a small one up the creek, and it was full of wankers. and you're like real stupid people, and you're like, why are you at a stand-up comedy gig?
Right.
But I wonder, do you think the UK is good for stand-up, and have you seen a change over the last few years in stand-up?
Well, I mean, I have to be honest, I'm not a proper stand-up in the sense that it's not my bread and butter. You know, my day job is writing. I go out and do solo performing, really, just because I enjoy it so much, primarily. But I would say that the big sort of stadium shows, if you like, I have noticed some people kind of have to sort of really coarsen their acts, you know. Suddenly you get these big extravagant mimes going on while they're relating the material.
Mm.
And there are times when you think, that's too much artifice going into that now. It doesn't really... But it's like... They seem to be like a collective experience, don't they, the big sort of O2 shows? It's a bit... It's like an... It's a night out. I mean, any comedy night is a night out, but it seems to be the audience experience. I mean, I should imagine it's quite difficult to time. If you've got a laugh that's going to wash around a massive auditorium.
Well, you hear a wave of laughter, I would imagine, and it hits the back, and then you get the wave coming back again. It must be very difficult in terms of timing.
Yes,
it's quite a difficult skill. It doesn't necessarily make for a good gig, but it must be quite a skill. So when was the last time you went and did a tour?
I think I did a show called Hat of Doom, which I toured a few times. Which was a lovely show to do. It was very free because at the interval I used to ask the audience to leave questions on bits of paper on the stage, and as time went by, you know, increasingly the whole of the second half would just be spinning off stuff they'd asked on those bits of paper. I think that's about 2 years ago that I did the last sort of I did a mini tour.
So why are you going back on again?
Just because I felt like it.
Why not?
You know, there was a, you know, so I sort of created a window and tried to protect it. And primarily just to get out there and have a good time.
So you wrote, you said that you had asked the audience to write stuff.
Yeah.
Do you love audience interaction? Are you keen on audience interaction? I like heckling, I like talking to them. Not heckling, talking.
Heckling isn't quite talking. Yeah, I like talking to them. And sometimes it would lead you down. One of the questions I remember once was a guy, and he left the question, "What is my middle name?" So I think me and the audience spent a good 20 minutes trying to guess this guy's middle name. It's like some huge parlor game, you know.
My mate's middle name's Ghislaine.
Ghislaine. It's like the girl's name, Ghislaine.
It's a Belgian. I don't think you'd have ever have got that. You could have you'd still be here now trying to guess that one. listen, let's play a song and we'll come back after this. It's what do you fancy? What about that?
What Becomes of the Broken Hearted?
Yeah, you
by
fancy
Jimmy
that?
Ruffing.
Excellent.
Yes,
we'll play that one.
That's a good choice for someone.
Okay, excellent. This is Andy Hamilton here with Tom Latchman on Foo Bar Radio.
I know I've got to find
is Tom Latcham. I'm still here with award-winning writer and comedian Andy Hamilton, who's going back on the road with his new tour about changes. What do you think of the current state of British comedy? And also, you write for telly.
Yes.
Do you think that commissioners are too safe?
Sometimes I feel that. Yeah. I mean, yes. If you're going to, I think it's understandable. I don't blame them for it, because I think there's always been, for as long I've been writing for telly since 1976, and for as long as I've been writing, there's been that fear in the air. It's always been there, but I think it's more pronounced now. It's more in the foreground of people's thinking.
Do you think it's more so at the BBC or it's across the board?
I'd say it's probably across the board. I think all the broadcasters have different question marks hanging over them commercially that they worry about, and I think I think they all worry, and so you are in a position. It's dangerous to get too sort of holier than thou as the writer, because you are, you know, if someone backs their judgment and goes with you, they are putting quite a lot of themselves on the line, you know. So you have to understand that.
Does it limit you?
It can do if I mean, you know, luckily I write with Guy Jenkin a lot of the time, and somehow when there's two of you, it gives you a little bit more kind of resisting power, you know, and things that you feel are important. I mean, I think, you know, you try to hold off any compromises in areas that you think are important, but I think if marketing get involved too early, that's a big change. You know, I don't remember seeing anyone from marketing for years and years and years.
Really?
Yeah. And I think, you know, sometimes they're there very early. Someone was telling me the other day about a series that was had been set in the West Country. And then someone came in and said, our research shows that viewers would really like to see a show set in the North. You think, well, what sort of research? What sort of question is that? You know, would you like to see something set in the North? Yeah, all right. There you go.
Not the West Country. Can't stand it.
Yeah, no.
I want to be in the North. And lots of your comedy over the years. I mean, you're obviously a regular guest on Have I Got News For You and QI. Lots of your comedy has been around news and satire and that sort of stuff. What makes news such a rich source of comedy?
Well, fundamentally, they are just like us. I mean, I think it's easy to imagine that all politicians are, you know, their own special creature. But they are like us, except that...
they're lunatics.
They've got and they've got power.
Yeah. This is a dangerous, toxic combo.
Yeah, you know, what you've got to imagine is that someone as useless and incompetent and as vain as you has now been given the
trigger to the nuclear bomb.
Right. They're flying the plane. And, you know, I mean, I think, so, you know, most of the comedy, the richness of the comedy is a very human elements. And it's interesting how often the big kind of geopolitics can get dwarfed somehow
by Cameron fucking a pig.
Well,
allegedly.
Yeah. Or just by, I watched Putin and Obama last night trying to do their photo call. You know, and clearly one of the obstacles to fashioning a political solution to the Syria problem is going to be that Obama and Putin clearly are physically repelled by each other, you know, and it's, they just can't stand each other, and that will be an element.
Well, they couldn't even clink glasses. It's embarrassing.
No,
I know. Pair of bellends.
Yeah.
And is the current political landscape, do you think, because you've been in comedy, you joined the BBC in 1976,
yep.
Is that correct?
So I didn't join the BBC. I wrote for the BBC.
Well, I thought you joined them.
I've never been staff.
Probably for the best, although your pension won't think so. Is the current political landscape now better or worse than it's ever been for comedy? Or, I mean, I imagine that rolling news, the concept of rolling news, you see everything of a comedian, so that must aid comedy in many ways.
Yeah, I suppose it would make it faster. Mm. Certainly you're more responsive.
But what about the personalities?
Well, until recently, it had got a little bit dry. Although you still had, I mean, you know, if you look at the relationship between, say, Blair and Brown, that played out like a sort of Greek drama, didn't it? You know, you had some very big, powerful, intriguing personalities. But it had gone a little bit flat. I mean, the good thing from a comic perspective is that things seem to be shaking up a bit again now. And you've got the comedy of the old guard refusing. Like, I was watching Peter Mandelson last night trying to laugh off his rage at the Labour conference. You know, I mean, it's a soap opera. That's what it is. But when I started, it was, you know, the big figures were Wilson and Callaghan and Healy, you know, who were, you know, quite larger than life, comparatively.
You've written sitcoms as well, one of which probably your finest, or rather, you know, certainly biggest, was Outnumbered. Mm-hmm. You wrote with Guy Jenkin. Why do you think that was so popular?
I think, in essence, it was popular because it we tried to capture the sort of chaos of bringing up three small children. I think a huge amount of it was kind of familiarity, recognition, people saying, oh yeah, we sent our kid to school even though we knew he had nits, but we just didn't have time. You know, there was a lot of recognition. And I think the other thing was I think now, because the program's been around a while, people forget how different it looked when it started. But when it started, I think we managed to get a level of naturalism out of the kids that hadn't been seen before. So.
Do you think it'll... is it finished now? Will it ever come back? Like, Cold Feet is set to return, for instance?
Well, I mean, I think as a series, I'd be very surprised if we do another series. But
the kids would be too old, probably.
Do the kids, getting their pensions and stuff. but we do hope to... We plan to visit the family for sort of kind of one-offs and let the audience catch up with, you know, where Jake is at now at uni and, you know, and stuff like that. You know, those kind of rites of passage
continue. In the process of being written, or have you got any plans?
We are,
when you're
me
doing
and
them?
Guy, on our wall in our office, we have a list of ideas and we're trying to, you know, to work out, what, you know, because if you do a special, you want it to be special, so.
And also it probably would be a Christmas thing or something, would that be when it would happen?
Ideally.
You probably missed it now, well, you would have missed it this
Christmas. The problem with Christmas is that, A, we've done quite a few Christmas specials.
Right.
And B, you kind of disappear in a sort of big morass of Christmas programming. You get a big viewing figure, but so we're kind of inclined to maybe do it somewhere else if we can. I mean, that'll be a discussion that, you know, me and Guy have to have between ourselves and then with the BBC. But
are the BBC keen?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Yeah, no, they've indicated they'd have us back, yeah.
All right. And do you anticipate a time for that? A time period for when it might happen?
We're hoping to do it. We're hoping to film it next year.
Oh,
so,
great.
Yeah.
So you'd put it in autumn, wouldn't you? Because autumn's when the big audiences are watching, right? That's why you have launch of Britain's Got Talent, not Britain's Got Talent,
that's how
X
it always
Factor
used to
and
be.
Strictly.
Yeah, autumn was always the great sort of spawning season. And that was always the time when viewing figures were going to be the highest. I don't know if that still applies. Mm. I mean,
get it on after Strictly.
Viewing habits. Yeah.
that's the key.
Well, that always has been. I can remember writing that one of my first shows at BBC TV was, I worked on Les Dawson's show, The Dawson Watch. And we did okay figures in weeks one and two. And then in week three, we shot to, I think it was number two, from nowhere. And the reason was we'd been moved to after Top of the Pops.
Yeah, listen, piggyback on someone else's success, man. That's what I'm trying to do. No worries about that. And what do you think about comedies like Cold Feet, Dad's Army, Blackadder, all coming back?
I don't know. Well, it depends how well it's done, I suppose, and what people do with it.
Would it be? It would be very. Do you agree? It would be very, very sad if, say, for instance, you know, Dad's Army and Blackadder were piss poor.
Yeah, Blackadder, presumably it's the same people making it.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's talk of it happening, yeah.
That, well, that, I've got no problem with that. Dad's Army, where they've recreated it,
yeah.
I haven't seen that yet, but, I mean, that's a bolder move, and I would have thought a more chancy one.
Right.
No, I've got no problem with the people who created it reviving it.
And obviously, you know, going back to the idea of change, which is your
yes.
Your stand-up show that you're going to be doing. How much change have you seen over the years in terms of the TV writing process?
Well, me and Guy, we've kind of we still write in pencil. And we give it to someone to type up.
We had Sarah Franken, comedian, a stand-up comedian in here. She's doing something for someone, and she hasn't got a computer. She was writing a storyboard in pen.
Right.
So
yeah, I don't work on a computer.
Really? Why?
I never really... the honest answer is I never really got my typing speed up to the same as my kind of...
So you'd probably be forgetting it
thinking
by the time you've
speed.
Typed it.
And also something about the scratching it out on a piece of paper is, for me... part of the sort of creative process. So but the way we look at it is, you know, we're creating employment if we type out our own scripts, you know. We're job
that's
creators.
What I say about having a cleaner doesn't make me any less of a socialist. I'm creating wealth. I'm redistributing the wealth. Any major ambition still to do?
Not really, no.
Well, that's a good place to be, isn't it?
Not really. That's sort of, but that could be the story of my life. Not really. No, I mean, my only ambition is to keep doing interesting things. Yeah, keep working, keep doing stuff that I find interesting and enjoyable. That's about it.
Well, it's lovely to see you, and thank you for coming in and talking to us. And your new show, Change Management, runs throughout October and November in the UK, and people can find out about it. Where is our website? Or
yes, there must be.
There must be. Google it. Don't use Annie's computer. That was Andy Hamilton there, and this is Tom Latcham. We'll play him out with the it seems an apt song, David Bowie, Changes. How about that, Andy?
Thank you very much.
Excellent. Good luck with the tour, mate.
Thank you, Tom.
Cheers.
And my time was running wild in the dead-end streets. And every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me. But I've never caught a glimpse of how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
Don't wanna be a richer man.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
It's gonna have to be a different man. Sides, but never leave the stream of warm permanent sand. So the days float through my eyes, but still the days seem the same. And these children that you spit on as they try to change their worlds are immune to your consultations. They're quite aware of what they're going through.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
Don't tell them to blow up and out of it.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
Where's the shame you've left us up to her next to me?
Time may change me, but you can't twist time. Strange fascination.
Changes are taking the best.
Business with Matt Haycox. In association with Access Commercial Finance. Creative commercial funding.
Hello, this is Tom Latcham here. It's 11:30, and as we say, joining me in the studio now with Victoria Richards, freelance journalist, and my co-presenter for the day, still here. Say hello.
Still here. Hello. Enjoying it.
As I say, joining me in the studio is Matt Haycox. Now, Matt is here to talk every week. It's a new regular feature. He's here to talk all things business and offer real-world advice for companies, entrepreneurs, and those who are in their companies in their infancy, creating that idea they've always had. And he'll be giving advice from someone there who's been there and done it. He's had an interesting past, having started in the leisure industry, instantly turning around the fortunes and profits of clubs like Spearmint Rider. And from there, he established a brokerage service and became a financial expert. So from pulling pints in his own pubs to serving on the board of a PLC, he can draw on his business journey, to give advice that is grounded in reality. Hello, Mr. Haycox.
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
How's Leeds?
It's good. I left there very early, so I can't tell you how it is today.
Are you as tired as I am?
I'm very tired.
Well, we'll try and perk you up, keep you perked up. So, as we said in the intro, you have had an interesting past.
I certainly have.
Tell us about your interesting past.
How far back would you like me to go?
The interesting bits, probably.
Well, I've always wanted to be in business, or always had wanted to be in business, and I think it probably dates, you know, back to 16, 17, 18, and I'd, you know, do anything possible to try and make school finish as quick as possible, and you know, avoid uni and trying to earn some money.
How did you make your first pound? Then, were you like a little miniature 15-year-old Dell boy from Leeds, obviously?
Yeah, without the Robin Reliance. The first thing I ever did was I made a website back in the early days, where you could buy domain names, do something to them. I bought.
When was this?
This was back in 1996, 97.
Wow!
I had
look at that foresight.
Well, it was an almost exciting sounding story, which ended up with me making nothing more than 500 quid, I don't think, at the time. But I bought
Nowadays you could have bought a house back then.
do you remember Natalie Imbruglia?
I do. What happened to Natalie Imbruglia?
I bought the natalieimbruglia.com website, and it was my great plan to ransom her and a PR people that, you know, how have they missed this trick. In the end, I think I ended up selling it to a fan or a stalker, as we'd say nowadays. And I got 500 quid.
But if you'd have kept it. That eventually she would have wanted that.
But then I would have had to have suffered the rises and falls of her celebrity, and even you guys have just said, where is she now, right?
Well, so at one point, yeah. You know, it's like stocks and shares, isn't it? You know, don't hold it for too long.
But maybe 500 quid was the top of the market.
But then there's someone, I think, bought the Coca-Cola one or something like that, and basically Coca-Cola said, you bought that nefariously. And they had to hand it over. I think it was Coca-Cola. Yeah, it was a big company like that.
It's a lot more organised and regulated now. Now, I remember at the time I did that, a friend of a friend had bought and sold SpiceGirls.com.
Wow.
And
did they do well? A bit more than 500 quid?
They got a bit more than 500 quid, yeah.
And so then what? I mean, what other stuff were you doing?
I moved into leisure initially. I said leisure bars, clubs, pubs, and you know, people always say, why?
Not fitness leisure.
No. As you just noticed from that very dodgy photo we took.
That's not true. He's a slip of a man. Anyone, particularly standing next to me,
dressed in black.
Yes, particularly standing next to me, you look fantastic. Yes, sorry, carry on. Bars and pubs and clubs.
You know, I didn't have any background in the market or any reason to want to be in it, other than like every 18, 19 year old guy, you think, I want to be there, you know, pulling pints and maybe meeting a girl or two. And I got involved with some you know, very much bottom of the market pubs, more out of necessity than anything else. Mm-hmm. I mean, a real kind of council estate, fighting and drinking, hardcore drinking.
My favourite kind, yeah. Frankly.
And one led to another, led to another. I won't pretend any of them were remotely successful, really. But I knew something was lacking from our income stream. We couldn't make money on beer alone, and I decided to venture into lap dancing. Again, for no reason more than that, I was probably spending five nights a week in lap dancing clubs, and it was probably going to be a cheaper avenue to earn one, even if we didn't earn any money.
Follow your passions, basically. Exactly. That's what you're saying as business advice.
You were going in as a consumer, and you decided to go into the business.
Yes, right. I like that word, consumer. It almost legitimises it, right?
If you've got a passion for something, and I suspect this goes for all business, if you've got a passion for something, that will that'll keep you interested, even if it's slightly struggling. You've got a real passion for something.
Yeah, I would say I always used to believe that as long as the passion was for money, that would be enough to drive it. But I think over the last 10 or 15 years, I've been involved in businesses that I've loved and businesses that I've understood but not loved. And there's no doubt that the ones that I'm completely behind are the ones that ultimately end up being more successful. Whether or not that's coincidence, who knows? But I think it's very important to be able to get up in the morning and love what you do.
And I imagine that not everything's gone to plan for you. If you made mistakes in the past, and have you learned from those? And how important is that in following a business and making a business a success?
I mean, my big mistake, if you like, came around the kind of 2008-2009 recession, financial crisis. And just dropping back to the story of moving into lap dancing, I opened a venue back in 2004 called Wildcats, and it was kind of the right place at the right time, hit the ground running, over the next 3 or 4 years. We became the biggest operator in the UK. Like you say, we took on failed venues from the likes of Spearmint Rhino that they couldn't make work, and we put our brand, we put our magic on there, and we had a very successful business. But it was at the time of easy money and over leverage, and looking back, I don't think anyone was probably more over leveraged than me. We'd used the lap dancing business to move into normal bars, normal pubs. I had a finance business, a retail business, and then when the brakes got put on in June, July, August 2008, we were so heavily geared, it was unrecoverable, and I went through a very trying time. We lost some of the businesses, we managed to save others, and when you say what would I do differently now, it's very much opened my eyes to not being over leveraged, to being sensible. But that said, I think I wouldn't change. Maybe I would change, but I'm not unhappy that what happened at the time when it did, because it's opened my eyes to so many other aspects of business. And it's very easy when things are going right to think we're amazing, but it's the more trying times in business which happen more and more frequently. That
it must have been really hard. Like, it must have affected you personally. How did you sort of keep your head above, not falling into a pit of sort of doom and gloom?
I think just out of sheer desperation, really.
Lap dancing.
Yeah.
Not you. I'm not suggesting you were lap dancing to keep your head above water. Just consuming lap dancing that will keep your spirits up.
No. I didn't have any choice to have an alternative. I was probably 28 years old at the time. I'd had a phenomenal run. Made a load of money, probably spent a load more, and it was really a matter of shit. I can't let this happen. How are we going to get out the other side? It's just more, I suppose, more and more experience that we bring to the table now when we look at funding other businesses, which I'm sure we'll come and talk
and
about
so
soon.
Where do you find yourself now? That's to explain a bit about that.
I mean, I've continued to be involved in the leisure sector for almost 15 years, but I kind of wrapped up my involvement in it beginning of last year. Throughout the whole time, I've run a finance brokerage, which a combination of you know, lending our own funds and brokering deals for businesses. And that's what we I do now. That's, you know, that's a combination of advising businesses, you know, lending them my own money, helping them borrow other people's money, but really bringing more of a kind of a full service to the table of, you know, not just what money do you need, but, you know, how can we help you better. And a lot of the clients that we deal with are people who are struggling, you know, maybe they're only short term struggling, and there's a good business in there underneath if they can get rid of some of the crap that's around it or see the wood from the trees and refocus. Mm. So, you know, we don't just walk in and go, oh, you want to borrow 50 grand, you want to borrow 100 grand, whatever, here you go, no problem. You know, we really kind of partner up, want to understand them and bring real world advice. That,
so it's like a mentoring.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, where we would differ very much from from a bank or from another finance broker or another lender is that, you know, we've really been there and done it. And yeah. You know, I always say to my customers, you know, I was a borrower a lot earlier than I was a lender, mm-hmm. and I know what it's like to be on your side of the table. And you know, if anyone can help you, you know, pluck money out of thin air, then I'd like to think it's me.
Okay, mm. Great. Well, we'll play a song. It's lovely to have you, Matt. Welcome to Foo Bar Radio.
Thank you for having me.
We'll stay there and we'll play a song, and then we're going to bring in a couple of guys who are running a new business, and they'll tell us a bit about that, and maybe you can grill them.
I'll try my best.
In a nice way, obviously, because they're standing outside and I don't want to scare them. But yeah, we'll do that. But we'll play a song first. This is Love Within by Block Party. I'm here with Matt Haycox and my co-presenter for the day, Victoria Richards. It's Foo Bar Radio. It's 11:41.
Some growing torn now.
Hello, it's 11:44. Coming into the last quarter of an hour here on FUBAR Radio, my Tuesday show every week. We've got this currently in the middle of a business section with Matt Haycox, who's our new business expert, who's going to be in the studio hopefully every week for a while, Matt, if he can drag himself down from Leeds.
Until we fall out.
So he might not be on again. And we're here with my co-presenter for the day, Victoria Richards, who's a freelance journalist. Now, we've been talking about businesses and how Matt, you know, helps fledgling businesses. And we've got a couple of guys in the studio who have set up a fledgling business. Now, technology suggests it won't be long before estate agents are a thing of the past. Probably no bad thing. I'm trying to buy a house at the moment, and they are honestly beyond moronic, estate agents. Unbelievably annoying. And research shows that by 2020, half of all property sales will be conducted online. And in response to their changing culture, these guys, EMOH, is that right?
MO.
Yeah. MO, have launched a new online property marketplace similar to sites such as eBay, ASOS, and Depop. Hashim Rafai and Cameron Chowdhury, have I pronounced that right?
Yeah.
Excellent.
Right.
They join, they're here in the studio now, as you can hear. So tell us, chaps, what is your site all about and what makes it different to what's already out there?
Cool. So what we've created is an online property marketplace. It lets homeowners list their property to sell themselves. You can list your property in 10 easy steps. And really, it's for people that are frustrated with estate agents, people that don't want to use estate agents, and people that think they can go at it themselves. And really, you can. What do estate agents really do for their money? How can they really justify charging 1.5%, 2.5% commission when really all they do is just market your property? Nothing you can't really do yourself.
Mm. And what's different towards the out there? I mean, imagine that Rightmove is a fairly similar site.
So Rightmove, actually, they cater towards estate agents. So what they do is any property that you market with an estate agent, they'll put it onto Rightmove to try and get the viewers. So if you're actually trying to sell your property on your own and you don't want to pay an estate agent commission, you can't use sites like Rightmove or Zoopla because they don't let private sellers list on those websites. So what we've essentially created is a Rightmove or Zoopla for private sellers.
Yeah. What's your marketing plan going to be then to compete with the likes of Rightmove? I mean, you're obviously very established and
Yeah, of course. I don't think we're trying to compete with Rightmove. What we're trying to do is offer an alternative.
I didn't so much mean
So our marketing plan, we've got quite an extensive marketing plan. We've just released a few press articles. We're going to try and get some outdoor advertising on the tubes, billboards, that kind of stuff. Also just doing different radios, press releases, social media, online advertising.
Just we think our growth is going to be organic because what we really need to do is kind of educate people that you don't need to use an estate agent. So once we start getting the word out there, people start thinking, well, maybe I can do this myself. We hope that people start just driving traffic to our site.
Well, that's the sort of thing that people, speaking as a freelance journalist, I don't know what you think about this, Victoria, but we had a conversation the other day about buying a house to me because I'm buying a house at the moment. You've got a nice place in Wanstead. I think that idea is novel and people don't know, and that's the sort of thing that you could get a lot of features out of in newspapers.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hot topic, isn't it, especially in London, where no one can afford
people love talking about property in London.
Basically, what I'm saying is, why don't you hire me as a PR?
Are you charging private sellers to appear on your site then?
No. So we're free to list. There's three things you do need to list on our website. So that's photos, floor plan, and EPC. If you don't have those three things, we can offer that for you as a service. But if you do, then it's completely free to list.
Okay. So how are you making your money other than those additional services?
Yes, it's literally just through those services.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what's your background, fellas? And are you got a tech background? Is that got a property background?
Yeah, I've actually got both. I set up a property fund 2 years ago. I was running that for about 2 years, and then last year I was set up a tech company. We kind of creating an app for local businesses. Unfortunately, they didn't go too well.
But that's with small startups, right?
Yeah,
they often don't go well, and that's the beauty of small tech startups is that there's a word for it. My mate's doing one. It's not pivot or something, but you go to a point, you realise it's not quite working like that, and then you sort of fold and move in another direction, and that's how because they're so small and flexible, and a lot of big businesses are looking towards tech startups and how they manage in a much more fluid, small way that they can improve. That way, right?
Well, the statistic is that 8 out of 10 small startups will actually fail.
Right.
But the learning curve is that you do learn a lot, and it's mistakes that you can then just avoid making the second time around.
And how do you fund your way through these mistakes? Because obviously everyone needs money. You know, you need to live, you need to pay your own rent.
So When we first came up with the concept, we were, you know, kicking around asking for investors if they would fund the idea. Luckily, we did meet an investor who believed in the idea enough to back it and really help us push it forward as well.
Mm. Is that going to see you through to profitability and on then? Or
yeah, it will. Yeah.
Can you talk to us about the name? I mean, I know it's MOs at home, but when I look at that, I think emo, as in, you know, there's lots of connotations with the word emo, course, right? So why did you decide on that?
Kind of like the reflection of home. So when you look at our website and you see a property, it could potentially be your next home. So we chose MO as kind of a reflection.
It wasn't just a quick decision. It took us about three months to come up with a name.
Right.
I was kind of sold on it. I came up with the idea and Harshim didn't want to go with it.
Yeah, I wasn't sold.
But I bought the domain before he even agreed and I was like, look, this is what we're doing.
You should have bought Natalie and Brilliant.
Extra 500 quid.
He's still got it for sale.
And are you looking for more investment or are you're okay as it is or what? I mean, you can always use more money, right?
Yeah, as in, I guess we could always use it, but right now I think we're good with what we've got.
So tell me something that I've felt recently from personal experience. I've been selling a house, and I'm, you know, the world's untidiest guy. And to me, the house looks great, and every time we do a viewing, the agents ring back and say, "Oh no, they didn't like the house because it was untidy. It was this, that, and the other." And I suppose in my mind, I think surely they've got to be able to see past a mess on the floor, but they can't. I mean, because you're taking the agents, you know, completely out of the process.
Yeah.
Do you not feel you're going to need to educate the sellers in some way, you know, to present the property in the best way, to, you know, to not negotiate? Because I know you say it's like an eBay, but it's got to be more than just showing a house. Yeah, I want to buy it. You know, the agents may charge a lot, but they do actually provide something more than just a shopfront.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think what you're talking about, what the agents do, is when somebody wants to come to your house, they'll obviously accompany the potential buyer and show them around. Something like that you could do, but when it comes to stuff like keeping the house tidy and presentable, obviously sometimes people they don't obviously think about it. But what we do is offer tips along the way. Mm. So if someone does want to book a viewing and they want to come and see your property, we'll obviously just send you off a quick tip or an email. Just say, look, someone's coming to your house. Just try to make it presentable, keep it tidy, just so it looks the best that it can. Mm. And obviously, We try and offer help wherever we can along the way, but
so you're not going in and taking photos of people's houses.
No, so it really is just trying to promote a DIY kind of approach to selling your home.
Mm. It's also actually worth noting that no one knows your home better than you can, not even an estate agent. So if I'm coming to view your house, you can give me information that an estate agent can't. Mm. So for example, if you've got kids and I've got kids, you could tell me where the best local school is, where the parks are, where nice little cafes I'd take them on the weekend. Stuff that stages will just really give you the same kind of talk to every property you go. So no one can really sell your house better than you can.
But I mean, a lot of house sales now seem to be based on open days where you get like 25 people going at one time.
Yeah.
Is that something you're encouraging?
No, because we want it to be intimate. We want the homeowners to kind of give you kind of the advice and information about the home that only they can give you.
Mm. Have you done market research? Are you finding that people are... As I say, I'm looking for a house at the moment, and when the estate agents come, they do your nutting, mm-hmm. and you're like, I wish you weren't here.
Yeah.
And the ones that I've been to, where they haven't been there, I found much more productive, mm-hmm. because they, as you say, you know your house better than anyone mm-hmm. else, and they'll show you around, and they'll be honest as well. They'll show you little things, that's a great tip there. They know the neighbours, mm-hmm. which obviously as well is a sort of thing. Have you done market research that you're finding that people are increasingly sick of estate agents and their bullshit, basically?
Yeah, so there's an investment bank called Jefferies. They did a survey, and their survey was actually surprising because it showed that 79% of homeowners would list their home to sell privately if there was a portal to do so. When we read that, at the time there wasn't a portal, so we thought, do you know what? Now's the time to create it. 79% is not a small number.
No.
So, I think that, you know, the key for me is how fast and how wide you can get it out for the purchaser base, because we're all of the opinion that the estate agents charge a lot for probably doing little, but if you're selling it, let's say you're selling £1 million property, and we said, okay, it's a 1.5%, that's 15 grand. You know, what have they done to earn that 15 grand? I think, you know, until you guys get the traction with all the people out there looking to buy via your website, you know, in the grand scheme of things, 15 grand isn't a big price to pay to sell £1 million house if you get it done in a month or 2 months, as opposed to if it's going to take you a year or 2 years, you know, because you haven't got the throughput through. But I love the concept. I think it's just going to be, you know, how fast you can market it, because you know, the likes of the Right Moves, etc., you know, they're very established, and you're brave guys to take them on.
Well, yeah, these things do take time. I mean, even Right Move, I think they took a couple of years or 3-4 years before they even got any major traction. It's all about how we market it, what message we want to portray, and how people, you know, perceive the business as well.
I think what was important for us was just that we felt that there had to be some kind of alternative, even if some people choose not to use it and they prefer using estate agent, that's fine. But as long as the people who want to try and do it themselves, they have a kind of platform that they can use. I think for us to just offer that platform as an alternative was kind of...
And how many places have you got on there at the moment? And where are they?
Oh, we've got eight properties. They're based around North London at the moment, because that's where the word has been spread.
You got one in Turnpike Lane?
No, we don't. Actually, we do.
Because I'm looking in Turnpike Lane.
Yeah, we have got one.
And where can people go? What's the website?
Yes, the website is emoh.com. Okay. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Okay. The links are at the bottom of the website.
All right, great. Hashan Rifai and Cameron Chowdhury, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having
us. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
If it goes well, when you're multi-millionaires, you can come back and...
I might give
me some money. Thank you for coming in, guys. Thank you very much. And Matt Haycox, thanks for coming in and doing this first business thing. Have you enjoyed it? Has it been fun?
It's been good fun.
Would you like to do more?
I'd love to.
Good. Yeah. Excellent. Well, that's excellent, because we'd like to have you back too. Victoria Richards, thank you for joining us and being my sort of co-presenter for the day. I hope you've had fun too. Thanks to everyone who's been on today. TV documentary Chris Atkinson did the papers. Top comic and writer Andy Hamilton, who came in and talked about his new tour, as I say, businessman Matt Haycox, who's our new business guru. He's going to be in weekly down from Leeds, feeling as tired as I am every week. And also those guys there from Emac.
I'll be renting a room when you buy a house off these guys, and we can have an extra couple of hours lying next
week.
You can
be right? Granny flat, man. but no, in fact, I actually went to a place in Turnpike Lane recently, and it was quite big. It was weird. There's like, we're still looking at it, might buy it. There was rooms in the garden that they built. Wow. And there was like Eastern Europeans living in every single room. Shows you how big it was. There's like 10 people that live there. So
that sounds like my first lap dancing club.
And with that, on that bombshell, thanks for listening, everyone. Coming up at 4 p.m. Sarah Hewitt Talk 2. Download my interviews as a podcast from iTunes and SoundCloud. I'll see you next week from 10 till 12. I've been Tom Latcham. This is Fubar Radio, and we'll play out with the Maccabees with Spit It Out. See you later. Till the pit. Bye.
Bye.
Spit him out.